Napa know-how.
There are lots of amazing cars on the road, but perhaps none more amazing than the paid-off car. It may not be pretty, but the price is right. Heck, if you keep that thing running, it'll actually start paying you. Because with Napa Rewards, for every $100 you spend, you'll get $5 off. So keep your car running longer, stronger with Napa Rewards and watch the savings start rolling in. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
You are Locked On Clippers, your daily Los Angeles Clippers podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hi, I'm Lucas Ann, and thank you for listening to Locked On Clippers. If you like the Locked On Podcast Network and you're interested in joining our team, this may be your chance. The Locked On Podcast Network is hiring a national sales manager. You can be a part of the fastest growing sports podcast network, selling the NBA channel, NFL channel, and the entire network to our national advertisers. If you have the skills, the perseverance, and the game to be a part of the Locked On Podcast Network, email lockedonpodcasts@gmail.com with your resume. That email address again was lockedonpodcasts@gmail.com. Now enjoy the show. Hey everyone, welcome to a new episode of the Locked On Clippers podcast. I'm your host, Lucas Ann. Today is Monday, June 5th, 2017, and we're going to talk about a little bit of minor Clippers news, talk about Game 2 of the NBA Finals, and then keep on going with our off-season prep as we get ready for what will be a crazy free agency period in July for the Clippers. So, first of all, just following a quick little announcement from the Clippers today, as we've known from throughout the last season, the Clippers have been working with the Hawaii Tourism Authority to try to put together some sort of connection between the Clippers and Hawaii, and they officially announced today something that had kind of been hinted at in the past. The Clippers will play two preseason games in Hawaii. They're going to call the event the Hawaii Classic. They're hosting it on October 1st and 3rd in Honolulu. So they'll be playing against the Toronto Raptors in both games. I guess it just makes sense from the NBA's perspective not to fly all the way to Hawaii just for one game. So the Clippers and the Raptors will play each other twice on October 1st and 3rd at the University of Hawaii. There will be a big fan festival at the convention center. I think it's kind of a joint effort from the Clippers and also the NBA to really drive up a sort of Hawaiian NBA fan base. I don't know if there's really any practical way to have an NBA team in Hawaii because of the travel. You know, just the flights would be insane for teams visiting there just for one game. But the Clippers already broadcast their games in Hawaii, so I think they'd love to really stir up excitement and tap into that fan base. And, you know, it's a marketing thing. But so, that, you know, that's the announcement from today from the Clippers PR team. They're going to be holding those two games in Hawaii. So I guess if you need an excuse to go to Hawaii and the Clippers are a good enough excuse, then cool. It seems like if you're going to go to Hawaii, it would almost be, well, I can see the Clippers when I'm in LA, but now I'm in Hawaii. I don't know. But it'll be really cool for Hawaii fans, you know, people who actually live there, to be able to see the Clippers. I actually don't know, just off the top of my head, just of the Clippers fans who I regularly hear from on Clips Nation, on Twitter, or in my emails, I don't know if I have any Hawaiian Clippers fans who regularly interact with me. So if you are a Hawaiian Clippers fan, reach out on Twitter, at Lucas J. Hand. Let me know, and let me know how you feel, you know, if you're super excited about this event or not. Now, that's just a brief little blurb coming from the Clippers today, but I want to talk a little bit more in-depth about Game 2 of the NBA Finals, where I know a lot of people were disappointed or perhaps even disillusioned with the Cavaliers' big-time loss. And, you know, I don't know that there's, like I said after Game 1, I don't think we learned a lot. Things kind of went how they were supposed to go, or at least in a way that could have been anticipated. And just like in Game 1, the Cavaliers lost, and it wasn't especially close. But you can point to a couple things that could break their way a little bit better to make them be close in the next game. In Game 1, it was the turnovers and the, you know, not really getting bench contributions. In this game, it was a combination of Kyrie Irving not having a great game, 8 of 23 from the field for 19 points. And then a lot of the role players disappearing. J.R. Smith, 0 of 2, 4 fouls in 14 minutes. Channing Frye, 1 of 5 in 11 minutes. Darren Williams, 0 of 5 in 14 minutes. Iman Shumpert, 1 of 6 in 22 minutes. And then the overall three-point shooting. So not just with the substitutions, but with them as well as with the starters. 8 of 29, 28% from 3. The Cavaliers have a lot of shooters on their team. You look down the supporting cast, J.R. Smith, Richard Jefferson, Channing Frye, Darren Williams, Kyle Korver. These are all guys who have the potential to come in and swing a game by hitting a few shots. And none of them have. Kyle Korver had 8 points in this last game, 1 of 3 from deep. That's really it. Darren Williams hasn't contributed. Channing Frye didn't play in game 1 and then was pretty bad here in game 2. And the Cavaliers just need that scoring punch. Now, there's been a lot of talk about the Cavaliers playing fast versus slow. I don't think it's about fast versus slow. I think it's about offense versus defense. So whether the Cavaliers are playing quickly or slowly, I think because of the shooters they have on their team, they're capable of getting hot and being more efficient on offense than the Warriors are. Because they're not going to out-defense the Warriors. That's never going to... You know, they're not going to... No one is ever going to stop this Warriors team or hold them to, like, an 85-point game. But if you limit the possessions and get really good shots for your three-point shooters and hit at a high percentage, you can score more points than them in a moderately paced game. The Cavaliers right now, you know, they took 100 shots in game 2. That's like a crazy amount. They had 113 points. The Warriors only took 89 shots, 11 less field goal attempts, 11 more turnovers, and still 20 more points. That's not a matter of how many possessions you're playing, although maybe it would help the Cavaliers to slow it down so that LeBron can get a little more rest, but it's more a matter of the potency of your offense. And the Cavaliers shooting 28% from three while the Warriors shoot 42% from three, at that point, it doesn't really matter which two teams it is. If one team is shooting 42% from three and one team is shooting 28% from three, the team that shoots 42% is normally going to win. That's a big, big factor. Now, there are two main reasons why people didn't have as much hope for the Cavaliers this season, despite them winning the championship last year. The first is that obviously Kevin Durant raises the level of the Warriors much, much higher than it was last season. And the second is that the Cavaliers themselves never really seemed to peak this season. They didn't seem to get back to that championship level. They struggled throughout the regular season. They were 51-31, so they had the same record as the Clippers. The Clippers obviously not being in the NBA Finals, missing Blake Griffin and Chris Paul both for chunks of the season. Same record as the Cavaliers. Cavaliers, you know, they took care of business in the playoffs, but they certainly didn't do it with the same ease as the Warriors, and they seemed to struggle at times. And even when they were winning, they weren't playing. When you watch them play, when you watch their defensive rotations and how their offense was running, they didn't look like a championship caliber team. So you look at a Cavaliers team that isn't playing up to their ability, and a Warriors team that has gotten even better from last season, and people didn't have a lot of hope. And now the Cavaliers are down 2-0, which makes people have even less hope. Now, you know, lightning normally doesn't strike twice, but the Cavaliers were down 2-0 last year too. Two games in Golden State, two losses. They went back to Cleveland. They were able to win a game in Cleveland and then win game 5 in Golden State, game 6 at home, and take game 7 to win the championship. Now that's not necessarily a repeatable recipe for success. It's a highly, highly difficult path to go down 3-1 against probably the greatest team of all time. But it just kind of goes to show, you know, I don't like when people say, oh, this series is over. LeBron James is on the other side of the court. The series isn't over. even if the Golden State Warriors are going to win, and I thought they were going to win before the series started, and I thought they did after game one, and I think they're going to after game two. Like I said, we haven't learned much. But I think we've also learned over the last 10 years not to count out LeBron James. He's still going to have an impact. He's still going to be phenomenal to watch, whether it's for two more games or for five more games, whether they get swept or win in seven. So that's, I mean, I guess that would be the main counter to sort of the argument that you hear a lot, that this isn't fun because the Warriors are so good. And I get it, because it would be way more fun if you didn't know who was going to win. But I think LeBron James puts just enough doubt in the equation to make it watchable. Pretty much every other series that the Warriors have played in, it wasn't especially watchable because there was no doubt. Like, if you guys remember, in that Portland series in the first round, the huge debate wasn't if, does Portland have it in them to pull off the upset? No, the huge debate was, if Portland has a perfect game, can they beat Golden State once and make it a five-game series? That was the debate. Not can Team A or Team B win. Can Team B possibly hope to take a game off of Team A? And the answer was no. You know, they had a couple close games, and then the Warriors really came to play in the fourth quarter and put it away. Second round, same thing. Third round, a little more of a challenge until Kawhi Leonard went out in the middle of game one. And now here in the finals, you know, they're 14-0 in the playoffs so far, trying to get to that 16-0, never been done before postseason. Is it anticlimactic? I think it depends on the person. You know, people are big on jumping on, there's no way the Warriors could lose, but the Warriors did lose last year when they won 73 games in the regular season. Now, I just hope that something happens with this Warriors team to create a little different level of parity going forward. Now, I don't think necessarily league-wide parity is a good thing. I don't think we want 30 teams winning between 40 and 42 games. But I do think it would be better if the best team wasn't so far away from the second, third, fourth, fifth best teams. There's always going to be teams that are bad and teams that are good. And I think that's important, you know, for sport and competition. But you look at, for the team that's the best, the Warriors, to be so significantly far above the second best team, probably the Cavaliers, and then the Cavaliers are a little closer to like the Spurs, Clippers, Rockets tier. But the Warriors are just like a complete step above that. And there's not really a way for any of those teams to close that gap. And you can attribute it to whatever you want. You know, they drafted well. They got lucky with Steph's ankles and the cap spike. It's a combination of everything. Just like any success is a combination of skill and luck, right? But it's just type of thing where I think you hope down the line that someone like Klay Thompson chooses to leave the team, and now they've got Steph and KD and Draymond all with max contracts, which is an unbelievably dominant trio, and they're going to be very, very good and one of the best teams in the league and still compete for championships. But with those three all on huge max deals and very little money to spend on the shooting guard and center positions and on the bench, they'll start to have more flaws. And so you'll have that greatness contrasted with flaws. Whereas right now, it feels like that greatness in the starting lineup is contrasted with Andre Iguodala and Sean Livingston off the bench, who are two very, very good players. Iguodala was the finals MVP 2 years ago coming off the bench for them. So, you know, I don't want them to be not great as much as I hate the Warriors, because greatness is good. The league should have great teams It shouldn't be evenly distributed talent. But too much greatness, maybe when we remember it 20 years from now, we won't think this way. But right now, it would be more fun if we hadn't all known in July what was going to be happening here in June. Now, to finish out this episode, switching gears from the finals back to a more Clipper-centric perspective, we're going to talk about the Clippers returning free agents. So if you remember from our conversation on Friday, we discussed kind of how difficult it is to anticipate what the Clippers roster needs are going to be this summer. Because when you look at it, they could really be anywhere from totally capped out with Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, Carmelo Anthony, DeAndre Jordan, looking to sign minimum salary guys just to fill holes in the bench. Anywhere from that side of the spectrum all the way to the extreme other side where they've got maximum salary level cap room and just a few scattered pieces on the roster trying to put something together, but ultimately likely just aiming for a high draft pick next season to start a rebuild. So how do you anticipate those needs when you can go from anywhere to minimum salary, maximum salary? This is what we're looking for, guys. We need someone to make between the minimum and maximum salary. Okay, so any player in the NBA, that's what they're looking for. So I think when we're considering these this wide range of possibilities, in every scenario, the Clippers are going to come up with a few needs, whatever they are. If Chris Paul leaves, the Clippers are going to need a stopgap point guard. Even if they're not trying to win games, they're going to be trying to develop guys like Austin Rivers, Bryce Johnson, Diamond Stone, and any other young free agents that they target. And in order for those guys to develop, they need to play with an NBA caliber point guard, which means Austin Rivers and Jamal Crawford should not be playing point guard 48 minutes a game for the Clippers. Raymond Felton probably even be. Maybe he'd be still a fine backup behind a younger guy, but okay, the Clippers are going to need another point guard. If Blake Griffin leaves, the Clippers need a solid big man. Even if Bryce Johnson is going to get more minutes there, they need somebody. And more importantly, they'll need to fill out the roster with youth. But if those guys stay, okay, well now the Clippers need an extra defensive wing. They need a replacement for Mo Spates. Do you keep Raymond Felton or do you replace him? These are the issues you start coming up with. And so whatever situation the Clippers end up in, they're going to have to deal with a lack of tools. Every NBA team deals with this. You have to fill these spots, whatever they are, with whatever tools that your team happens to have at their disposal, be it cap room, the mid-level exception, a first-round draft pick, or in the Clippers' case, as it seems to be, a lot of uses of the minimum salary exception. Now, like we talked about, in last summer, the Clippers knew what those needs were. They knew, okay, we need a backup point guard, we need help at small forward, we need a backup center, we've got the mid-level and the biannual. They spent the mid-level on Wesley Johnson, the biannual on Luke and Mbamute. They got minimum salary guys at point guard and center. Okay. Now, this summer, we don't know what tools the Clippers are going to be working with outside of their own roster. So the Clippers could very well have a max contract to offer a guy like Gordon Hayward if they were going to try to do like a quick rebuild around someone like him. Or they could end up with only minimum salary contracts to try to pursue guys like Jose Calderon or Roy Hibbert to come off the bench at point guard and center. But what we do know is that they're going to have certain tools with regards to their own free agents. The guys who were on the team last season. And then we'll figure out what they're going to have to offer other people. Now, the nice thing is the Clippers can exceed. So let's, for example, the Clippers can offer Luke Mbamute about $8 million a year this summer using his early bird rights, which means they can exceed the cap to offer him $8 million a year. But if they have cap room, they can offer him more than that if necessary, which it probably won't be in Luke's case, but that's just an example. So there are three kinds of free agency rights for players who were on your team last season. Bird rights, early bird rights, and non-bird rights. Bird rights apply to players who've gone 3 or more years without switching teams as a free agent, which means your rights can be traded with you, but once you sign with a new team of free agency, you no longer have bird rights. Early bird rights apply to players who have gone 2 years without changing teams in free agency, and non-bird rights apply to players who've gone 1 year without changing teams in free agency, which is essentially everyone. So for bird rights, you can offer a player the maximum salary, 8% raises, 5 years, the whole thing. Early bird rights, you can offer players the greater of 175% of their previous salary or 105% of the league average salary. And non-bird rights, you can offer players either 100% of their previous salary or 120% of the current minimum salary, whichever is greater. Now, for bird rights, which is the three or more, the maximum salary, the Clippers have Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, and J.J. Redick. Now, Paul and Griffin, we talked in depth about their contract options last week, are going to get maximum offers. And if the Clippers want to have any hope of retaining them, they're going to have to offer them the maximum salary. So, in this case, you know, it's nice that they have the bird rights so that they can exceed the cap to do that, but it's also not much of a topic of conversation. The more interesting case is J.J. Redick, who, as we noted in the exit interviews, began to slow down last season. We started noticing his weaknesses a little more against quicker guards, bigger guards that have, you know, a little more length and athleticism, and then his disappearance in the playoffs really called into doubt his future with the team. Especially as Chris Paul, his counterpart, ages, the Clippers are looking for, you know, a shooting guard that can help a little bit more with defense and ball handling, which are two things that J.J. Redick does not do. So a lot is up in the air as far as J.J. Redick's future, and his salary could be possibly $20 million a year, which is a lot of money to commit to a guy who you aren't sure of, and especially won't be sure of 3 years from now when he's still making that money. But this is a tool. It's an option for the Clippers, whether they choose to utilize it or not. They can pay J.J. Redick up to the maximum salary to keep him. For early bird rights, which is two or more seasons, the Clippers only have one player, who is Luke Mbamute. Luke Mbamute obviously played for the minimum 2 seasons ago. Last summer, he signed a contract for the biannual exception. He made $2 million last season. He had a player option for $2.3 million next season, which he's going to decline. And the Clippers can pay him up to 105% of the league average salary. With the cap jump and all these new high salaries, that's about $7.8 million starting. With 8% raises, this gives the Clippers the option to pay him something. The maximum they can pay him, really, would be on a 3-year contract, $25 million, or on a 4-year contract, $35 million. Now, we don't know what the market is going to be for Luke, and I think ideally the Clippers would be able to get him for a little less than that, something like 3 years and $18 million, like $6 million a year instead of up in the $8 million a year range. But the Clippers also would not be able to sign a player of Luke's caliber unless they lose their stars and get cap space. So to be able to retain him, exceeding the cap by giving him that $8 million salary would still be worth it if that's the type of contract that he ends up demanding on the open market. Now we get to non-bird rights. And this applies to Raymond Felton, Mo Spates, Brandon Bass, and Allen Anderson. These are all players who've been with the Clippers for 1 year. So they're eligible for the greater of 120% of their last year's salary or 120% of the current minimum salary. Because the new collective bargaining agreement is taking effect on July 1st, the minimum salary is going to increase rather drastically, and this means that 120% of these players' previous salaries doesn't really come up to par with even what the current minimum would be, not to mention 120% of the current minimum. So here's just an example. Mo Spates, his minimum salary as a player with 9 years of experience for next season is $2.1 million. The Clippers, with that 20% bump that they get from his non-bird rights can offer him about $2.5 million, which is great, except that most Bates is probably going to demand between $6 and $8 million on the open market, and the Clippers just are going to have that kind of money if they keep their stars. For Allen Anderson, he's not really going to get more than the minimum anyway, so the Clippers aren't in a situation where they would need to give him that 120%. But Raymond Felton and Brandon Bass are two guys that this could actually help the Clippers out with, because I think everyone kind of agrees that Felton and Bass both have utility and both were an asset to the team last season, even if Felton contributed more than Bass, or at least had a larger role than Brandon Bass did. But they're two guys who generally you like to have on your roster again. Felton, you know, Bass, I think it sort of depends how different things shake out. But if you find yourself in a situation where you would like another veteran big in that, you know, 10th man, 11th man, 12th man spot where he was this season, he's about as good as you could hope for. And the ability to pay Brandon Bass 120% of the minimum is significant, because Brandon Bass is a guy who likely multiple teams will be interested in him at the minimum salary, because he's a solid veteran backup big. But at his age, and because of how he's a little limited, he's not likely to get more than the minimum. Raymond Felton is similar. Raymond Felton, you know, the league has so many point guards, so many teams want young point guards, that it's doubtful anyone's going to really pursue him with bigger money, like a $5 million a year salary, especially because he still has some weaknesses as a player. But there's going to be a lot of interest around the minimum. So for these two guys, who both have 10 or more years of NBA experience, their minimum salary for next season is $2.3 million. The Clippers, offering them 120% of that, can give them about $2.8 million. So that extra half $1 million for one season is significant, especially when you consider that they might even want to come back to the Clippers anyway, or maybe they don't want to move, especially Brandon Bass, who played for the Lakers in LA before coming to play for the Clippers last season. Now, I kind of wanted to mention this regarding the 120% of the minimum salary, especially with Raymond Felton, because I've heard from people, you know, I've sort of had in my mock off-season plans all along re-signing Raymond Felton for the minimum, because we know he's a good fit, we know that Doc Rivers can trust him, you know, he's a good player. There's no need to take a risk on someone else who might flare out like Jordan Farmar did when you know you have a solid guy already here. So you re-sign Raymond Felton for the minimum, and then you can, you know, you're set at backup point guard, only having to use the minimum salary, and you can keep your mid-level exception to try to keep Mo Spates or add a wing or add a new backup center or whatever. And people are saying, well, you're not going to be able to get Raymond Felton for the minimum. He had a good year last year. Someone's going to come in and offer him $2.5 or $3 million. Because that's what happened to the Clippers last summer. They went after a lot of guys who normally would be minimum salary players, but because of the huge cap jump with everyone having extra cap room to spend, the Clippers were coming in with minimum salary offers of $1 to $1.5 million, and other teams were just using cap room to give $2.5 or $3 million out. So it makes sense that the same thing would happen to the Clippers here, where Raymond Felton's minimum last season would have been 1.5. If someone comes in offering him three, twice as much money, he's probably going to take it. But with the minimum salary increasing, and the Clippers now being able to offer Felton 120% of the minimum salary, that 2.8 is right in that 2.5 to 3 range that people were worried he'd be poached away for. So at the very least, even if he does get those offers, which I'm not convinced that he will, the Clippers will be able to put forth a competitive offer to try to keep him. Now, this is just the Clippers' own free agents. Obviously, they're going to have more options with how they sign outside guys. Because they used the biannual exception last summer, unless they clear up cap space, they'll pretty much only be able to use the mid-level exception this year and then sign minimum salary players. But we're going to look in the coming weeks about different guys the Clippers can target for the mid-level exception and for the minimum at different positions, as well as how they could potentially swing a trade. Most likely the trade we'll focus on is the Carmelo Anthony deal, since that's talked about so much, and how that would potentially shape the roster differently and change the Clippers' needs rather drastically. But for now, this is the end of our Monday episode of the Locked On Clippers podcast. Be sure to tune in tomorrow and for the rest of the week as we continue talking Clippers basketball every day. As always, if you have any comments, questions, or feedback, you can hit me up on Twitter at LucasJHan or email me lhan.clipsnation@gmail.com. And be sure to check out the Clips Nation blog at www.clipsnation.com and follow Clips Nation on Twitter at ClipsNationSBN. Thanks for listening. This is Lucas Han signing off for Locked On Clippers.